This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, where I go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, and oddballs who are making the 21st century more libertarian, or at least more interesting, by challenging old, worn-out ideas and orthodoxies. My guest today is Pablo Holman. He's a legendary hacker and cypherpunk who holds over 100 patents and has worked with people like Bill Gates to cure malaria and Jeff Bezos to get Blue Origins off the ground. Pablo also runs a venture fund called Deep Future, which is committed to creating technology that matters. In his new book, also called Deep Future, he exhorts the reader to boycott dystopia and describes companies that are saving bee colonies by using mushroom spores to inoculate bees against pests, recovering ancient Roman secrets to make concrete that lasts for thousands of years, and launching solar panels into space to deliver a constant, uninterruptible supply of clean energy. We talk about why he believes we need to be moving faster with AI, why hardware ultimately matters more than software, and why decentralization will eventually triumph over the Facebooks, Apples, and Googles of the internet. Here is The Reason Interview with Pablo Holman. We're talking with Pablo Holman, a hacker, a cypherpunk, and we'll talk about what that means, a futurist, a venture capitalist, a better on the future. He's the author, most recently, of the book Deep Future, Creating Technology That Matters. Pablo, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks.
The book is subtitled Creating Technology That Matters. What is technology that doesn't matter?
I think we kind of live in this world where we think it's full of technology, but it's mostly just full of software. And so I think we're setting our sights a little low the last couple decades because, you know, if you just have like, you know, I don't know, iPhone apps to have weed delivered to your dorm room by a drone, that doesn't really feel like technology to me.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, it's taken our attention away from all kinds of other things, other technologies that can make a bigger difference.
So, I mean, part of it in the book, you go into it and it's not just saying, okay, well, software drools, hardware rules, but I mean, you do make a distinction of like, and even in that example, like the drone is something that is going to use a lot of software, but it's hardware. It's something that is in the world and makes us kind of move into the future that maybe we once dreamed of or thought about without really knowing what it would be.
Yeah, I mean, software, nobody loves software more than me. My best friend from childhood is an Apple II. And so it's turned out to be this kind of incredible tool that we can use that's generally applicable to everything. Mm-hmm. And that's important. But now that we've kind of done software to everything, we would need to get back to doing the other stuff.
Yeah, and so when Mark Andreessen says that software is eating the world,
I say the world can't eat software.
Yeah. Okay, we explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, because, you know, if you think about, you know, food or clean water or sanitation, construction, manufacturing, energy, all these things are things every human on Earth relies on, but you won't radically improve them with software.
Right.
You can make them like a few percent better, and we're doing that, but you're not going to make them 10 times better. And so that's what I think of when I'm talking about deep tech, is technologies that could go after those bigger problems.
Okay, so this is your definition of deep tech. Mm. Deep tech is about finding the breakthroughs that make it possible to do things 10x, 100x, 1,000 times faster, cheaper, or better. That kind of force multiplier will always win in the long run. You also run a fund that is called Deep Future.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the companies that you're investing in, because this is where it comes down to like, okay, we're not talking about a software app, you know, where you can buy a piece of pizza that's delivered by drone or by bicycle or whatever. You're talking about, like, give me the top of mind example.
We invest in these like mad scientists. So they're like, you know, coming out of a lab and into a startup. And most of them have some kind of breakthrough or we wouldn't bother. One in New York, I should have had him come tonight. I don't know where he is. These guys figured out that that plants protect themselves from bugs using like this mushroom spore in nature. And they've been able to take that mushroom spore and then evolve it to target different invasive species of bugs. And they're using it right now to save bee colonies from the varroa mite. So the reason bee colonies are wiped out is this little bug called varroa mite is eating the bees. Well, they put like a tea bag of mushroom spores in the beehive, and it will wipe out the mite and save the bees. It's this amazing, beautiful thing, but it's not software. So I don't know. That's one.
About the Roman concrete?
Oh man, that's another good one.
I mean, in reading this, this was, and I had been in Rome earlier this year for the first time, and I was like, okay, you know, the most amazing thing about it is the Colosseum is around after over 2,000 years or something.
Or the Pantheon, which is even more miraculous. So if you've seen that thing, it's like the dome building in Rome. And it's 2,000 years old. It's made of unreinforced concrete, and it's in a seismic zone. So everything we build out of cement, which is like almost everything we build, is made of concrete with steel rebar to reinforce it, and then it crumbles in 50 years. And we can't figure out, nobody's ever been able to figure out, like, how did the Romans do that? And I found this guy at MIT who figured it out. And now we can make cement that lasts virtually forever, use less of it, use less steel, and the kicker is it's like less CO2. So there's nothing not to like about this, and you can do it at any cement plant. It doesn't cost more. You go in and turn some knobs and change the formula a bit. And so now they're in production, like they're building stuff with this cement, and it's just exciting. Like less than 10 years, we can probably upgrade all the cement being produced.
So with a company like that, when are they going to like fully come to market, or how, what is the time horizon that you use when you're investing?
Well, they vary a lot, but that one actually was not that difficult to bring to market comparatively, because they can license the new formulas to a cement producer. Mm-hmm. And so they've done that in Europe. They're approved in the U.S., and they'll gradually work their way around the world. And hopefully, in our lifetime, every cement project will be made.
So what I'm hearing is that you don't like people who pour cement. You want to put them out of work, or how do you deal with that?
I don't like the ones having to pour cement where we already had cement.
Right.
Yeah, like we should make it last a little longer.
A lot of the companies that you discuss in Deep Future have to do with energy or energy production. You talk about a company that that is going to use solar power.
Yeah.
By being in space where the sun never sets. Can you explain what they're doing?
It turns out if you just follow photons back to their source, you end up at the sun. And that is a weird thing, because we think if you look at what's happening with our solar farms, we keep making more and more of them, but the relentless onslaught of night keeps fucking with our solar panels. So we don't know what to do about it. But if you take the same solar farm and launch it into space, it'll actually get sun 24/7. So we have a bad angle on it, so it looks like it gets nighttime in space. No, it's actually noon in space all the time. So if you put a solar panel in space, it'll get sun all year long. It actually gets 8 times as much energy. And then you can beam it down to Earth using radio waves that go right through clouds. And this sounds like science fiction, I know.
But it really does.
Yeah, but it's real. Like all the technology we have.
So when will that happen?
They're aiming to put the first commercial array up in 4 years.
What are the biggest, assuming all of the engineering and technological questions are answered, is there a regulatory regime, or what is slowing that down or keeping that from happening?
We actually have a pretty functional regulatory situation for doing things in space. So that's less worrisome than it has been in other industries. So I think that'll work fine.
So is it mostly just the cost of putting stuff in space?
The cost of putting stuff in space was just laughably expensive for our whole lifetime. So like in a space shuttle, it would have cost $40,000 to get, this book into space. Now it's about $1,500, which is, down like 20x or something. But the Starship target that SpaceX has for their big rocket is 10.
So $10.
$10 a kilogram. So in this lifetime, you will store your old sports ball gear in space instead of your garage or closet. Yeah.
Do you really believe that?
Yeah, it's called space for a reason. We're really going to do that. Yeah.
And how does it work? I mean, with the solar panels, how does it work? Like you beam it down on radio waves. Like this
Yeah.
It sounds made up.
I know it sounds made up, but if you think about, like, we do radio communication all the time. We're moving data, not trying to move energy, but it's the same thing. And so with radio waves, we send a beam of radio waves. Different frequencies are good at different things. So, you know, X-rays go right through you. Sunshine mostly gets blocked. Well, the sunshine's getting blocked by the clouds. So if you can use radio waves, then they'll go right through clouds. So 10 gigahertz will go right around water molecules, so which is what clouds are made of, water vapor. So so you can use 10 gigahertz microwave radio waves that come down to Earth. We spec the beam to be a third of the energy density of sunshine. And so you need a big beam, and you need a big antenna on the ground, but it won't hurt you. Like, you can stand in front of it. I have. Obviously, I'm fine. That never convinces anyone. But
yeah. No, but, that, I mean, that third leg is getting a little bit creepy.
It's not a leg.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I know why you think that. Okay. Yeah. So, anyway. So, yeah. It's actually quite safe. It won't penetrate your skin more than a tenth of a millimeter. Yeah.
And then it'll be able to be just kind of redirected to whatever electricity or power.
Yeah. You make a beam and you aim it at a big antenna on the ground, and then that'll just go right on the grid.
In keeping with energy kind of production, because you talk about, you know, the problems that will improve life on Earth for, like, the most people and things like that, energy production is really the most important thing, because history has shown that as it's not just as we get more populous, but as we get richer, we consume more electricity, right? Or we need more energy.
It's not just because we're richer. We consume more energy. I mean, because we're rich, I guess. But a lot of people don't have enough.
Right. You know,
like, and they need to consume more energy, and they want to, not because they're rich, but because they need it. And like in the book, the way I describe that is, if you sort of average American energy production, or if you average global energy production, let's say, you get about one toaster per person. So you duct tape the button down on a toaster, run it 24/7. That's about how much energy the average earthling gets. And then Americans, because we're all sexy and good looking and so smart, we get 8 bonus toasters. So you're literally getting, you know, an insane amount of investment of energy in every single American. To get those averages, 3 billion people live on less than one toaster.
Right.
And so to me, when you look at a lot of problems, you kind of trace them back to energy. And I think we just didn't finish the job. You know, we've made enough energy for all the people in the West and north of the equator, however you want to slice it. But we just haven't finished the job. And so less than one toaster is not an acceptable living standard. You know, you want to get somebody up at least to, like, Europe used to be 5-6 toasters. Now they're more like 4 or 5. But, you know, that's an acceptable, you could call that acceptable living standard. So to do that, to get those averages out, we've got to 10x global energy production. And that is the thing that I'm saying that's kind of heretical. Most people want to show, like, a couple percent a year of growth.
Want to manage demand for energy rather than increasing the supply of energy.
It's a complete red herring because, you know, you could, like, just try it someday. Just try to cut your power consumption by 1 or 2 toasters. Like, that's the max you could do without starting to feel like, you know, you live in a third world country. And we're at the other end of that. We're at less than a toaster trying to go up. And so we have to provide for these people, and you can't overstate how important it is. You know, when you look around the world, what are people fighting over? What are all those wars about? You know, it's access to energy. It's control of those resources, mostly oil. So if you could provide, you know, a death ray from space full of clean, cheap energy to people, then what are they going to fight about?
Religion, right?
Fight about dumb shit on Twitter like Americans do.
To focus on, we can put the wars in cyberspace, right? And leave.
You think the religion is kind of a cover story for the wars about oil?
It's an interesting question, and I tend to agree, or certainly historically, wars are fought over resources, right? As much as anything. But then to continue with this, You talk a lot about nuclear energy. Can you kind of explain, your theory of nuclear energy in this?
Well, I worked at a lab called Intellectual Ventures years ago, and we invented the most advanced nuclear reactor called TerraPower. So if you see Bill Gates talking about nuclear reactors, that's the one. And
this is the one that he puts in the vaccines that he then...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you inject it into kids for fun.
Yeah.
Voluntarily, of course. So that nuclear reactor we invented in about 2007. Mm-hmm. And every year since then, we've been unable to get the U.S. government to approve it to build a test core. Nothing wrong with the reactor. It's just the U.S. government has no way of approving any new reactor technology. And the only thing they could possibly approve is old reactor technology. And so I have a lot of scar tissue from that because I've been trying to convince people that nuclear reactors are coming for almost 20 years. And I've been wrong all those years. But this last year, things really radically changed. So last year, a huge bipartisan bill was passed called ADVANCE to push for developing nuclear reactors in the U.S. Last month, Trump signed like 4 executive orders to push deploying nuclear reactors. And all the hyperscalers sort of woke up and realized, oh, to power all these chips we got from NVIDIA, we're going to need some nuclear reactors. So I think the world has radically shifted in the last year.
What is different about these nuclear reactors? Because this is, and you talk about in the book that nuclear power and nuclear weapons got conflated. And, when people talk about nuclear, if you talk about nuclear power plants, you think of Three Mile Island, you think of the China Syndrome, you think of, and you throw some shade on the No Nukes concerts, but there are no positive examples of, nuclear reactors
actually,
in popular culture.
True. 13% of our energy comes from nuclear reactors in this country. That's quite a positive example. You don't know anybody who lost their life to nuclear reactors. You do know people who lost their life, at least early, from the pollution from burning coal and gas and shit. So I think it speaks to what I tried to show in the book is that humans are like story-powered creatures. And when we get a story in our head, it controls us. And the story we got in our head was, we mixed up nuclear reactors and nuclear bombs. We outlawed the wrong one. Mm. If we'd done it the other way around, you never would have heard of global warming. That's what's possible. And we're still not being honest about that. Mm. And so it's time to get a new story. The cool thing is, my kid thinks Chernobyl is a TV show for old people. Mm. So...
it's like Godzilla, right? It's fiction, right?
You have to wait out. You have to wait out the story for generations sometimes, But we're at that point now, and I think I don't know. I kind of want to see if I could get, Bob Dylan to help us do like a Go Nukes concert.
That would be a Go Nukes would
might be too
awesome.
Much to ask
Go Nukes.
He
may be powered by nuclear energy at this point. Who knows? You were saying like war is about, resources or a fight over resources. Do you feel like, particularly with energy production, there's an argument that, even if we had free, cheap, non-polluting energy, we just shouldn't consume that much of it because it's wrong to be rapacious or gluttonous in our energy production.
Yeah, but there are other things that we do where we're rapacious and gluttonous for generations, and then we sort of learn to get it under control. Hmm. And I think you have to think about a lot of these technology adoption cycles as a life cycle. Hmm. We're in maybe junior high with social media, still pretty poorly behaved. We're barely in preschool with AI. For some things like email, let's say, we pretty much got it under control. And then, not to mention fire and knives and all the other shit you could really do some damage with. So I think these things, we're impatient, but you have to learn to get them under control. Kind of like, everybody overdoes it a little bit with drugs and alcohol, and most people sort of figure out a functional relationship with it. And then, there's some collateral damage along the way.
But with AI, you're talking about it less in terms of like, okay, we're going to, you know, I'm going to be able to write my resume better so that I get a better job. And it's more that AI is actually going to, you know, create better hardware. Can you talk a little bit about how that, you know, how your vision of AI is not like, oh, we're all going to be able to write like Shakespearean sonnets about whatever we plug into ChatGPT?
Yeah, I try to break it down in the book so people can really feel like they understand what AI is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're using a lot of, you know, complicated sounding jargon to make ourselves feel real smart. That's, you know, neural nets and tensors and transformers and all this stuff. But the truth is, it's not that difficult to understand. And so I try to break that down. And then I think of AIs as computational models. And a model is, you know, like we all build models. Like if you close your eyes and imagine being in bed, which way is the door? If you open that door, what do you see? Which way do you turn to go to the bathroom? Like all of you can answer that, because you trained a model in your head. And all of us trained a different model. The answers are different for all of us. I don't know where your bathrooms are. Come on, idiots. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm just wondering. And yeah. Kim Jong-un, of course, doesn't see a bathroom because he doesn't need one, right?
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
I got to try that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the point is, you know, you train these models and then your dreams in your daydreams, those are simulations in the model. What happens if, you know, my boss says this, or if I show up late here? Your brain is running those simulations. And so now we can make those models in the computer. We can simulate our world better and better and better, and we can run simulations. And so we did this in our lab for epidemiology, and that's really the thing that inspires me the most. We started, you know, this 15 years ago. We started advising half of the countries in the world on how to optimally deploy their vaccination resources and you know, epidemiological interventions. And so for us, it's very real. Mm-hmm. You know, in the first Ebola outbreak, 12,000 lives were lost. And in the second Ebola outbreak, a few years later, only 12 lives were lost, in part because using these models, we can get the better answer about how to contain that disease before it spread. That's what would have been possible with COVID, but we weren't trying. And so
why weren't we trying?
I think because, you know, we tried to raise the alarm. We had Bill do a TED talk about it in, like, I don't want to say 2015, 16, 17, around there. And then I looked on in March of 2020, right before COVID broke out, and 6 million people had watched it. I have pointless TED talks where that, like, way more people have watched than that. We should have got a Kardashian to do the TED talk, because no one's paying attention and no one cares about, you know, these sort of seemingly imaginary problems. Now we're all hopped up on imaginary problems, but we couldn't get people to worry about a problem that for Americans is imaginary. But
so AI, I mean, AI is going to become, it allows us to prototype countless scenarios or realities so that we're better able to figure out which way to go when something real happens.
I think you want to think of these as tools to help you make better decisions.
Yeah.
Now, you could still make dumb decisions, but at least you would know that's what you were doing. You can't plead ignorance anymore. You know, if you think of, like, I use Google Maps as an example. Google Map is an AI you've been using every day for 15 years, and you tell it where you want to go. I want to go to work. Even though you know how to get to work, why do you tell it? Because it knows traffic. It knows the best, fastest way to get to work. It has more data than you. And it can analyze all the data and give you a blue line. Here's how to get to work. But then it gives you a couple of gray lines.
Yeah.
You know, here's if you want to stop for a burrito or pick up some Starbucks. You could choose your possible futures. And it's showing you these are your possible futures. And you choose the one you want. That's the relationship we should have with AI.
Yeah, and you talk about AI. I mean, you call for an AI war of escalation. Most people are like, we got to slow down AI. We got to make sure China doesn't do too much. We don't do too much, et cetera. What is the AI war of escalation that you think is, you know, the moral thing to do?
Right now, the guys who are building AIs are being kind of disingenuous, most of them, in my view. They're saying, oh, AI is super powerful, but it's also so powerful that nobody else should have it except for us. And I think that's a lot of bullshit. You know, what should happen is, and will happen, whether we, you know, is we'll build a multitude of AIs. Mine should be checking yours. Yours should be checking mine. You know, we should be competing. You know, we should figure out over time, which one do you trust? I trust the people who built this one. I trust the answers this one has given me for years. You build trust in it the same way you do with a human. Like you know, people are like cool for a while and then you figure out they're a total asshole and you dump them. That's how we're going to do it with AIs. And so you need a multitude of them. And right, and so it's really the wrong track to get on to build AI in the image of how we built social media. Like, why would we do that? Why would we let a few companies control it? The reason that they're in the race to spend as much as possible because they don't really have a moat, right? There is no moat in the tech. We all have the same algorithms. Like, we can all build a ChatGPT ourselves. What we can't do is get as much compute as OpenAI got or as Meta's got or as, you know, xAI has. They've got the compute. And so now even the compute isn't a big enough moat. So now it's trying to control access to energy again. We're right back to the same wars we were having in the Middle East over energy, but now it's hyperscalers trying to buy up every last electron that you can get. You and I are going to pay for that. Why? Because they're fine with a dollar to pay like the levelized cost of energy. We pay 10, 20, 30 cents, not anymore, because now we're competing with hyperscalers. So I think it's a really bad track that we're on. What we need to do is recognize and that we're falling for, basically. We need to make a lot of AIs that fight each other.
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to ask you to help make this podcast and all Reason podcasts better. Please fill out our audience survey. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, and I'll give you a chance to win a $300 gift card. The link to the survey is in the show notes for this episode. It'll really help us out. And now, back to the Reason interview.
One of the things that's most remarkable about this book and refreshing is the optimism. And it's not utopia. It's not techno-utopian. It's techno-optimist. And you came of age in the 80s and especially the 90s. You have a chapter and a slogan that recurs in the book is boycott dystopia, which is pretty good, but it's rare to hear. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, how you got into computers and, you know, and end up or still have an optimistic view of technology. How old are you?
I'm 54.
Okay, 54?
I think so.
Okay. And you grew up in Alaska, kind of in the middle of nowhere, right? So talk about, you mentioned your Apple II computer was... You know, one. You know, it was an amazing thing. But how did you get into computer programming and kind of digital culture and the internet?
So when Apple shipped the first computer that they made, it was kind of the first computer you could have at home. The oil industry was the biggest, richest industry. My dad had put some of the first computers in the oil industry, you know, mainframes. And so when Apple needed customers, they're like, hey, want to buy some of our totally useless but expensive little computers? And he's like, sure, we'll take one. So I got one of the first computers Apple ever made, and in Alaska, which meant that nobody for like 1,000 miles had ever seen a computer. And so I didn't know what I was doing, but I just had more time because I was in the freezing cold. So I just would just fucking crash it and reboot it. That's how I learned. And so
what were you doing on it?
So on an Apple II, like it couldn't even do graphics. It's just text. You get a command.
And you would put the floppy in. That was the operating system, and then take it out and put something in to save the data on, right?
Oh, yeah. The operating system and your program and your data all had to fit on a disk that held 240,000 bytes, which is not, you know, that's like not very much. So it was pretty nascent. And at the time, like, I just wanted to convince people this thing was going to be amazing and useful. And nobody believed me because it wasn't. And then I had like a skateboard and they're like, that has more promise. You should just go waste time on the skateboard. Get out of the house. And the, you know, Revenge of the Nerds I was right, the Apple II.
Yeah.
Did kind of suck, but it eventually got more memory and it got faster and it went everywhere. And I just went on that ride. So a computer uses binary, as you all know. Binary is represented by like an alphabet called hexadecimal. And I could see the hexadecimal and I could learn to read it. And then I could try and take it apart and figure out what it did. So I would just change things. That's how I learned. I would literally just change a zero to a one. And then if it didn't crash, I'd see what changed. And then I would learn that way. So I reverse engineered my way into computers. That's totally not what you should do. Nobody does that. But I didn't know better. So that's how I learned. And then once you know what the zeros and ones are doing, then everything on top of that and every new thing computers could do, I just had to learn the new stuff. And I've been doing that my whole life. So it was hard to catch up to me. And that was... Yeah, so that's how I got started.
When did you connect to the internet, or when were you able to connect to other computers?
Well, that,
and you have a storied history as a hacker.
Yeah.
So
in 1982, I got access to the mainframe at the university with a modem. Mm-hmm. And the university had this giant mainframe, which had like so massive of a computer, it could do as much as like an Apple Watch. that's an exaggeration. It was, you need a lot of them to add up to an Apple Watch, but it's a shared computer. And so when you dial in, you could talk to other people and there's still no pictures. So nobody knows I'm a kid. Mm-hmm. I'm like 12 or 13. And I just spent 16 hours a day harassing computer science professors. They were the only other ones on the computer. So I would just say, how does this work? How does that work? And they would tell me. And so I probably learned more than anybody because they had real jobs and shit. I just had to fuck around on the mainframe. So eventually that was my first experience on the internet. And the mainframe wasn't internet, but there was this, it was made by DEC. So it was a DEC VAX mainframe for nerds. And then it had this thing called DECnet, so it could talk to other mainframes. And then from there was this thing called BitNet, which you could use to get to ARPANET. So I could spend like, you know, 3 afternoons crafting an email with all the headers and shit to try and get my email from me in Alaska to the East Coast. And it would take longer to get there than a postcard. Yeah. Like and if you got something back, it was like a miracle.
How did you feel like when that started happening more, you know, like quicker or anything?
Yeah. I mean, it was all very gradual in the same way that your experience is, but I you know, I was so lit up by this thing and I just, you know, I was, you know, whatever, 10-year-old kid trying to talk people into being excited about this computer. And you can see I'm still kind of doing the same thing.
Right.
I'm like trying to get people excited about these technologies. And I just felt like I had a superpower and I was right. You know?
By the early 90s, you started participating in something called the cypherpunk listserv or email, you know, service. Who were the cypherpunks and how did that form you?
Yeah.
And your relationship to technology.
So cypherpunks so here's the thing, you know, up until 94, the only people on the internet were nerds. Like you had to just be deep in it in order to even get online. In 94, you had like the first web browser, and then we started letting muggles on the internet. Mm-hmm. And what happened is all the wizards were like, oh shit, this is not going to play out well. Because we could see like, this isn't secure. We're going to end up with all these people causing mayhem. They're all going to get taken advantage of. This whole thing is going to go to shit. So that you could see that. You know, nerds and especially hackers are good at projecting out what are the problems that are coming. So what we thought was that, okay, we need to go make this thing secure and then get back to our usual day job. And what happened is we saw that, okay, it was very nascent, but in those days we thought, well, we could take the toolkit of cryptography and use it to create protocols that were totally secure. They were trustworthy, like nobody could cheat. And the reason for that is we didn't want to end up on an internet where anybody got an asymmetric advantage, where you control what I do, or I can stop you from doing whatever you want to do. The whole point was to make it egalitarian. And so the idea with cryptographic protocols is everybody, they enforce their own rules. Everybody has to play by the rules or you don't get anywhere. And so we tried to make these cryptographic protocols that could preserve our values of essentially freedom online. And that was what cypherpunks were really focused on. And we had to start with, so we did different things. First, we had to prove we could make a anonymizing system on top of TCP/IP, which was not anonymized. So that's really hard to do. So taking a system where everybody knows who everybody is and then trying to anonymize, we had to invent all the mixers and stuff for that. Now you know it as Tor browser or the dark web, because the descendant of all that work is anonymous surfing. That's Tor browser. If you flip anonymous surfing on its head, you get anonymous serving. So servers are anonymized. That's the dark web. So that was the first thing we had to solve. Then we had to solve decentralized protocol. And that was really hard because, when you're designing stuff, it just really helps if you can all just check in with the boss. And so everything ended up being centralized, and we tried to decentralize things. That was really hard for a long time. And one of the problems with decentralization is you need a way to pay people to contribute resources to the decentralized network. Well, that got us onto cryptocurrency, because we're like, well, how do you pay people? Can't be doing that with credit cards. Defeats the whole purpose. Cash doesn't work online. So we had to figure out, how do you put money online? So in the late 80s, that's what I was really focused on, is how do we make a cryptocurrency that solves the problems with, because currencies are also the way that most power is exerted. So we had to figure out, how do you get out from under the control that comes with it? Every currency ever issued in human history gets fucked with by whoever controls the mint. They just print war for their frat buddies. You can see it happening with the dollar today. So that's a big problem that you want to get out of. None of us could figure it out. And all the crypto, we made like 100 cryptocurrencies collectively. And they all sucked for different reasons. But the biggest one was, we could never figure out how to decentralize the mint. And that was the kingpin that Bitcoin solved. And so up until that moment, we couldn't get there. Before that, we did solve decentralization before that. So the milestone for that was BitTorrent. So before BitTorrent.
Explain how many of you are familiar with BitTorrent? How many of you are still using it?
Unwittingly, some of you are still. But the point is,
What does BitTorrent do?
So you guys remember Napster? So Napster was a centralized service where you could steal music from other people. Big crime.
I think borrow it.
Exactly. Or you could borrow it. Fair use. But, those nuances were lost. So with Napster, there's a centralized server telling you where to go get the song you want. Lynyrd Skynyrd's over here, and, Patti Smith is over there. So it fell to a legal attack. The guys running the server got sued into oblivion. No more Napster. So cypherpunks figured out how to solve that. And we had a bunch of different ideas and different iterations. But the winner was BitTorrent, which decentralized everything. And it was the first totally decentralized protocol for file sharing and, by extension, for everything else. And so with BitTorrent, entire industries hate it. Yep. Music industry, movie industry, and all that hate it, but they can't kill it. And that's what proved to us we can make decentralized protocols that are unkillable. Yeah. And then after that, Bitcoin inherits.
Before we get to Bitcoin in a second, I just want to, you make a great point in the in your book that, people are spending more on music than ever, and that the thief is not BitTorrent or piracy. It's the people who control the means of production, right, of music.
Yeah, a lot of business models basically map to controlling distribution, not even production so much, because they've all been intermediated by distribution. You can see that very clearly in the music industry. You can see it very clearly in I have a publisher for a book. Why? What? Same with movies. You got to get access to the theaters. Now you got to fix that. Now you got to get access to Netflix. Just put the movie on BitTorrent. Okay, we're done.
How would you get paid for that, though?
Bitcoin.
Okay.
Yeah. All of this is now technically solved. Yeah. I understand that there are some usability issues that we're still nitpicking over. But where this lands, yeah.
Oh, it is fascinating when you look at the music industry. I mean, particularly after World War II in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, literally criminal actors would go around and like lean on people to collect money for records sold or not sold or whatever. I mean, like if to read about the history of rock and roll is to learn about criminal actors.
Well, then it flipped and the criminal actors became legit and those were the A&R guys.
Yeah.
So then they go lean on the on the radio stations to play this song, play that, play my album, and like, you know, you do it.
Okay, so BitTorrent allows for decentralized file sharing. Yeah. Bitcoin allows for a stateless decentralized currency.
Yeah, because Bitcoin decentralized the mint, and so that's why entire governments hate Bitcoin. No one can kill it, and so and it is the first currency in all of human history where nobody can cause it to issue more to their friends. I mean, it's a fair game. Go mining Bitcoin, and that game will last another, I don't know, decade or something, and then we'll be done.
You, in the book, you say in 2008 you were testing a prototype of Bitcoin or Bitcoin in its early stages.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, so with every one of these cryptocurrencies, you know, the fringe wackos would get together and try it out and try to see if it works to do transactions and then bitch and moan about the things that suck about it. So it's a way to look. Cypherpunks are, on the whole, not well socialized. What I would say is the thing I treasure from it is that the discourse is incredibly antagonistic, but it is, but we all have the North Star of what's technically true. So if you have your North Star is what's technically true, all the attacks, you know, you can slander someone, it doesn't matter at all. It rolls off you because if you're technically right. And so we're all in search of what's technically true. And so if you go read so part of what's interesting about the Cypherpunks archive is it was all in public. All the discourse was on the list, mostly. And you know, anybody could go read it. But if you go read it, you're going to be kind of horrified because we're not exactly chums.
Right.
You know, but we love finding that truth, the edges of what's technically true. And so so that's the environment that produces this. And so when I downloaded Bitcoin the first time, I'm one of the first users. I was just trying to see if I could kill it. And I almost did because I had a supercomputer in my lab. I had 5,000 core computer doing nothing at night. I'm like, you know, because we part of the protocol, one of the obvious things from it is there's what's called a 51% attack. We'll get on to less technical shit. But the point is, if you could control 51% of the mining in Bitcoin, even today, you can rewrite the blockchain and win all the gold. So I was going to do it just to fuck with my friends, but fortunately I got busy and didn't do it because I probably would have killed Bitcoin.
That it sounds like a very unconvincing story.
Oh, what's unconvincing?
I was going to do it, but I got busy.
Oh, busy is unconvincing? I don't know, man.
Do you know who Satoshi Nakamoto is?
I'm not going to say any more than that. I said, you know, cypherpunks made Bitcoin, and I'll stand by that, but I'm not going to tell you anything you don't
already know. But who is Satoshi Nakamoto?
Cypherpunks made Bitcoin.
Okay. And they write code. Final question. Let's dial back to this question of boycott dystopia. What are the things that happened, you know, say from the early 90s, you know, as the web kind of democratized, you know, the internet or made it user friendly. And by the end of the 90s, the internet is a mass medium. You know, it's different than traditional broadcasts and all that kind of stuff or publishing or anything. But, you know, what are the, and it was criticized and challenged, you know, throughout the 90s. I mean, everybody, you know, right and left, all had reasons to try and shut it down. It came close. The government came close to doing it in the U.S., et cetera. What are the events that happened that turned, you know, this generally optimistic outlook to one that is really harshly pessimistic? And how do we move past that?
So in 2006, any of you who are on the internet probably had an RSS reader. A lot of them was using Google Reader. And what we were trying to do there, RSS was like a, you know, sort of a test protocol, you could say. The idea was, how do you decentralize publication? You know, how do you publish and subscribe? And it was working great. We're all using it. And so you had a decentralized protocol. It wasn't cryptographic in nature, and there's lots of problems with it. But when I subscribe to your blog, every day my reader goes and grabs whatever you put on your blog. And if I subscribe to all your blogs, it goes out to each one of you and grabs whatever is in your feed. And then my reader gets too much crap in it. So I make filters, like minus Trump, minus Biden, minus Elon, minus whatever pisses you off. I still, to this day, use RSS because of spaghetti code. It still works on every website on the internet. And so I have this feed of news that I have tuned over decades now almost. And I don't get the things I don't want. I only get the things I chose. And I control the knobs and dials. And what happened to the mainstream is they went from this beautiful and open system and ran into a big walled garden called Facebook. And Facebook does not give you the knobs and dials. They don't let you control your feed. They came up with their Uber algorithm that thinks somehow they're magically gonna come up with one set of values for everyone on Earth. Like, we all opted into this, and I guarantee you, we don't all agree about shit in this room. So I just think what we did wrong was fell for this story where we're gonna let Facebook determine value system for all of us. And we keep beating them over the head. We're like, you got to stop letting this content. You got to stop letting that content. You got to do more of this, not less of that. And we do it to Twitter and we do it to everybody. But we're just on the wrong fork in history. You know, the right fork in history was RSS. Don't give your attention to what seeks you. Save it for what you seek. That's how I think about it.
How do we, my life is like that. Yeah, we've gone down this dead end, like, how do we back up and go back?
I have some ideas. I mean, we could talk about that. But like, my idea was to, you know, try to, I mean, it gets too technical. But the point is, we should choose RSS. You can do it today. Download any RSS reader. I don't care which one. Doesn't matter. Go subscribe to whatever websites you like. And then go make filters for things you don't like.
Is it good that, you know, Facebook is a, you know, seems to be in decay in the U.S., right?
It's not in decay.
But the average daily users are smaller.
Yeah, we're getting old, so we don't use Facebook, and our kids use Instagram and Snapchat and stuff, but it's basically all the same shit, or worse.
So it's, I mean, it's the move. Is it the move into a single walled garden, or is it?
Yeah, that's why
we have multiple. We have multiple walled gardens, and is it okay to kind of hop, skip, and jump among them?
Let's skip forward. Right now, you know, we live in this world where we made these choices, and in the long run, and this is kind of what I think is, if you just look in the long run, any technology that humans invent and figure out and prove that it's good and economical and whatever, we always adopt it in the long run. Like, whoever invented the wheel was probably assassinated, but then, you know, for a few generations, kill off all those assholes with wheels, but then a few generations in, fuck you, dad, wheels are cool. Yeah. And then the technology gets adopted, normalized, and everybody gets it. And so we're kind of at this developmental stage where we just got drunk on Facebook and went nuts with that. But kind of like the story I told about nuclear reactors, we're going to evolve past that because these are better ways for humans to organize ourselves. That's what decentralization is. We're going to decentralize AWS. That's where this goes. So, you know, BitTorrent is a milestone. Bitcoin is a milestone. We are on our way to decentralize AWS. And then on top of that, we're going to decentralize all the things that we use. That's going to be messaging. That's going to be your newsfeed. That's going to be your Instagram and your OnlyFans, all decentralized. Yeah.
All right. Decentralized OnlyFans. That sounds like a great note to end on, where even the body parts will be on separate accounts. Totally. It sounds like it's just more money. Final question. How long have you been wearing the glasses, and where do you buy them?
I don't think anyone's asked me that on camera before. So,
no. No, they are super cool and futurist and retro all at the same time. So,
Let's see. So back in their heyday, the designers at Oakley were like gods. They could do whatever the fuck they wanted. So can I cuss on your show? I guess
sure.
Too late.
Yeah. So, it's easier to ask forgiveness than to ask for fucking permission.
Okay. But, yeah. There we go. So they built this factory in like Nevada or somewhere where it was, not under a lot of scrutiny, and they could do investment casting, which is an expensive way to cast titanium alloy. Mm-hmm. And they made these the coolest glasses ever made, the toughest glasses. I've been wearing the same pair for like 20 years. But the factory blew up because of all the volatile gases in the casting process. And so that nobody will ever make glasses this way again, but they're the best ones ever made. So because I'm in a lab all the time, I have to wear safety glasses anyway. And these correct my peripheral vision and they fit and they don't break and they don't fall off my head. So that's why I've been wearing them. And for years, people thought they were weird. Now I get compliments.
Yeah, no, they are the future. The book is Deep Future, Creating Technology That Matters. And the author is Pablos Holman. Pablos, thanks for talking.
Thanks. Okay.